I want to invite you this evening to open your copy of God's perfect word to 1 Samuel chapter 29. 1 Samuel 29 as we continue our study through this amazing book this evening. 1 Samuel chapter 29. We're going to work through these 11 verses this evening of this short chapter in 1 Samuel. And here in the beginning, I'm just going to read verses 4 and 5 of 1 Samuel chapter 29. I'll ask you to stand in reverence for the reading of God's perfect and precious word tonight. 1 Samuel chapter 29, verses 4 and 5, and then I'll pray for God's mercy as we study His perfect and precious word. Look with me at verses 4 and 5 of 1 Samuel 29. But the commanders of the Philistines were angry with him. And the commanders of the Philistines said to him, "Send the man back, that he may return to the place to which you have assigned him. He shall not go down with us to battle, lest in the battle he become an adversary to us. For how could this fellow reconcile himself to his Lord? Would it not be with the heads of the men here? Is not this David, of whom they sing to one another in dances? Saul has struck down his thousands, and David his 10,000s. Join me in prayer tonight. Oh God, I pray that as we open your word tonight, Lord, that you would change us and transform us. Help us to come face to face with your sovereign working in the world. Help us to see your providential control. Help us, Lord, to gain a sense of your wisdom in the unfolding of the affairs of the world. Help us, Lord, to bow before your plan, your purposes, and your ways. Teach us tonight. Transform our thoughts that they may more faithfully reflect the gospel. May the result of this evening be a people who better take every thought captive to obey Christ. We pray it in the name of Christ. Amen. You be seated. Irony. The dictionary that sits on my desk as I study offers this definition: incongruity between the actual result of a sequence of events and the normal or expected result. Just a fancy way of saying that there are a series of things happening that seem to be headed somewhere, and they head somewhere else. Irony. In literature, irony is defined like this: a literary technique that involves telling a story with an outcome contrary to what we expect. Life is full of irony. Life is full of those things that we think we know what's coming and yet we don't. Things that hit us in ways that we don't expect. Things that seem to lay out in this sequence and yet they head somewhere else. In our daily lives, there's all kinds of ways in which we come face to face with things that are ironic. Some things, silly little things. Even as I was preparing this, I was working on my computer, and there as I was working up on my computer, I had one of those annoying pop-ups come up. And yet this annoying pop-up popped up, and the pop-up popped up to try to get me to click on it because it was directing me to a place where I could get rid of annoying pop-ups. Irony. I never think about things that are ironic without thinking about the fact that Judy told her roommate the first time we ever went out with one another, now I'm going out with him, but it'll never amount to anything. And just this week in staff meeting, I don't know if this is ironic or just what it is, but just this week in staff meeting, we were in there talking about things, and we ended up talking about the fact that we were having a health inspector that had sort of looked at the kitchen area, and we were having to make sure we had some things taken care of over there, and we that just got us started talking about health inspections in general and all that kind of stuff. And I said, you know, health inspections and in restaurants, and I don't worry about those numbers in restaurants. You know, if they came to your kitchen and they started measuring, you know, you've got the Clorox under the sink and you can't have that, and they would condemn our kitchens. And just about the time I'm saying, you know, I don't care about health department numbers, there's a knock on the door of the staff room where we have staff meeting, the conference room. And, hey, the health department guy's out here in the hallway. He's here to check the kitchen. And I'm going, well, get him down there quick. And hoping he didn't hear anything that I was just saying. I wasn't talking about, I don't care about the health department number here at the church. But all kinds of things like that happen all the time. Things of timing and things that we don't expect and things that hit us in ways that we don't expect. But the thing I want us to understand this evening is that if you read your Bible and miss the irony, then you're missing the story. And far too often that is exactly what we do. Far too often we only read our Bibles as though it's just sort of a conglomeration of facts and we're just sort of gathering facts, or it's just a conglomeration of self-help information, and what we've got is the problem and we're looking for the verse and give me the verse to slap onto the problem, and it's just sort of that kind of book. And so we take that approach to the Bible and we don't even see the story and the flow and the ebb and flow of the narrative of the Bible, and we miss the flow of the story and we miss the point. If we miss the irony woven all the way through the Bible, then we are missing the very story and plot line of the Bible itself. We aren't supposed to read the Bible just like a fact book. We aren't supposed to read the Bible just like a self-help book. We are supposed to see the story. And when we see the story, we understand this clearly. God wrote the story. We didn't write the story. Because it keeps hitting us off guard. It's not what we would have put together. It's not the way we would have done it. It keeps taking us off guard. It keeps hitting us in directions we don't expect. It keeps taking us off balance. The story unfolds and God purposely keeps doing things in ways we don't expect because He keeps screaming that He is in control. In fact, He keeps doing things even like this, like teaching us that the firstborn is the one who has the right of inheritance. And then we keep reading the story and we keep seeing that the firstborn keeps being bypassed for the inheritance as God's story unfolds, because according to His sovereign choice, He keeps giving the inheritance to another. In other words, He's saying, I will choose. I will work my plan. This is my purposes that is this is my purpose that is unfolding. And everything about the story hits us in ways we don't expect. God chooses the most unlikely of people in the most unlikely of circumstances. And it doesn't all make sense why He does it. And at times He tells us He does it just simply because He does it. He doesn't do it at times because there's anything worthy in the people whom He's acting on their behalf, but He does it because there's just something within Him. He loves because He loves. He chooses because He chooses. He acts according to His purposes. And the story unfolds, and it keeps unfolding in ways that we do not expect. And all of it builds up to the climax of the story, and everything about it hits us in a way we do not expect. And it does so much that we try to shave off the rough edges around the way it takes us so off guard. There is a baby born of a virgin, and that babe is God in flesh. There is really the infleshing of God in the womb of a young teenage girl. And this is not a rich to-do family. And when that birth finally happens, it happens in the most grotesque of places with stench all around. And that's why when we put up our manger scenes, we clean it up a little bit. Because it takes us so off guard. And by the way, I recommend that. I mean, I don't recommend you to try to import the smells onto your shelf during Christmas time. Because I want you to know that in a place with live animals and a barn-type setting, it smelled like a barn-type setting. It stunk. And I want you to know that there was the stench of birth. And there wasn't the neat, tidy little thing to pull out and wrap up and put in a nice metal container and pull away. And I want you to know there was blood on the ground. It hits us in a way we do not expect. Smells. Animal waste. Blood. Stench. Animal noises. God in flesh. Do you see the way it hits us? We don't expect it. And it keeps going like that again and again and again and again. And what we've got to do, and what the Bible is trying to teach us to do, but what we so often do not work on at all, is we've got to develop gospel instincts about life. And developing gospel instincts about life means we expect the irony. We expect things to hit us off guard. We expect not to be able to figure everything out in neat, tidy ways. We expect God to be able to work in situations and to use circumstances and situations that we don't see anything good coming in. That's what we expect, because God has built that sort of gospel irony into our thinking through the Bible. That's what I want us to see tonight, and it's exactly where our text points us. The Bible keeps saying God is sovereign. He's made promises. Trust Him. He keeps taking you in circumstances to remind you He is sovereign. He keeps making promises. He keeps saying, trust Him. He keeps unfolding things in ways that are full of irony, that His people might trust Him in the midst of it all. You see, anytime we cannot control a situation, we immediately think that's the problem. If I can't control it, that's the problem. And here's what I'm here to say. Most of the time, that's not the problem, that's the point. Most of the time, that's not the problem. Most of the time, that's what God is doing to teach you what He needs to teach you for you to live the gospel in the world. Chapter 29 is reminding us of this fact. Chapter 29 is dripping with irony. To see what we need to see, we've got to pick up. We need to go back and remember that it picks up a story that left us on the edge of our seats before, that dealt with David. David was in the land of the Philistines, and it just left him there. And all of a sudden it flashed over to Saul, and Saul was in this situation with the witch of Endor, the medium of Endor, seeking wisdom there. And then you're in that scene, and now it is flashing us back to the scene with David. He's still there in the land of the Philistines, and we're left wondering, what in the world is going on with David? I want us to go back there and see what's going on and look at all of the irony of what God is doing here. In chapter, we're actually going to go back and pick up in chapter 28, verses 1 and 2, and in chapter 29, verse 1, we're going to see the keeper of the head. The keeper of the head. Let's go back even a little bit farther and look at chapter 27, verses 1 through 4. Look at what's going on there. Then David said in his heart, "Now I shall perish one day by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than that I should escape to the land of the Philistines. Then Saul will despair of seeking me any longer within the borders of Israel, and I shall escape out of his hand." So David arose and went over, he and 600 men who were with him, to Achish, the son of Maok, king of Gath. And David lived with Achish at Gath, he and his men, every man with his household, and David with his two wives, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail of Carmel, Nabal's widow. And when it was told Saul that David had fled to Gath, he no longer sought him. We come to a point here, and David says, listen, if I stick around any longer, Saul will kill me. There's nothing I can do except flee to the land of the Philistines. And if I go there, he will relent at this point. And we find out that's exactly what he is doing. He still believes that the Lord is going to deliver him. He just believes at this point that he's going to do it by escaping to the land of the Philistines. And that's exactly what happens. It works. He goes there. Achish is the king of Gath. He escapes to that land. And that's exactly where we find him in chapter 28, verses 1 and 2, and we'll pick up there. In those days, the Philistines gathered their forces for war to fight against Israel. And Achish said to David, "Understand that you and your men are to go out with me in the army." Now, we've got a problem here. If you'll remember, David has already been anointed, though he is not yet recognized in the providence of God among the people as the king of Israel. But he has already been anointed by the Lord and by his prophet Samuel as the king of Israel. But now he is in the land of the Philistines. Here he is with Achish, the king of Gath. They're about to make war against Israel. He's hiding out in the land. He's been making Achish think that he has been doing battle and attacking his own people. Achish seems to think that David is weakening Israel, and he is about to do battle and war against them, and Achish is calling David to go out and do the battle with him against Israel. This is not a good idea for David. David is to be recognized as the king of Israel. He doesn't need to do battle against Israel. And in fact, David will not do battle against Israel. We know that already, for he will not harm Saul. Even though Saul is bloodthirsty for David's life, David recognizes Saul as the Lord's anointed. David has spared his life twice, though he could have taken his life. He recognizes Saul as the Lord's anointed. He trusts in the Lord's timing. He recognizes that he is to be king, but he will not be presumptuous. And he recognizes God's timing. And so he finds himself here, though, and he finds himself being called to battle. But look at what he says in verse 2. David said to Achish, "Very well. You shall know what your servant can do." What does he mean by that? What does he mean by that? Well, what does Achish think? He probably thinks, "You're going to see what I can do when I get out there and help you in this battle." He doesn't say that. All he says is, "You're sure going to see what your servant can do." He certainly says an ambiguous thing here that is chock full of potential meaning that can be taken in a variety of ways. And we know, based on what's already happened, David has no intention of doing battle against Saul. He has no intention of doing battle against Israel. Certainly there is a sense in which, in the context of the warfare against them, against the Philistines, this has a double meaning here, and David intends to turn these words against Achish. But note what Achish says. "And Achish said to David, 'Very well, I will make you my bodyguard for life.'" Actually, more literally, "I will make you my head guard for life." The most literally we could translate this in the Hebrew would be, "Very well, I will make you the keeper of my head for life." Wait, now, are you serious? The king of Gath is calling David the keeper of his head for life? Can you imagine David's reaction to that? That has to be too much. Other than being anointed as king, what is the seminal event in David's life? Well, there is a mighty warrior of Gath. There is Goliath of Gath. There is the champion, Goliath of Gath, and he is mocking and defying Israel, and he is defying the armies of the living God. And all of the people of Israel, including Saul, are cowering in his presence. But there is but one, the Lord's anointed, a shepherd boy from Bethlehem that the Lord raises up, who goes out and kills Goliath of Gath. And the text keeps telling us again and again and again that he intends to cut off his head, to crush his head, to take his head. And then after he kills him, it tells us he cut off his head, he took his head, he grabbed his head, he had his head. It tells us he's either going to take his head off or he took his head off in 1 Samuel 17, 46, 49, 51, 54, and 59. I think it's making a point that the champion of Gath is defeated by David and he crushes the head of the enemy of God. It is an echo back from the promise in Genesis 3:15 that there will be a seed born of woman who will crush the head of the enemy of God. And there David does it. And now in the incredible providence and working of God, God has unfolded things so much so that David is hiding out among the Philistines, and God has given him this situation in which the very king of Gath would look at David and say, "You are the keeper of my head for life." And David's thinking, that's the best news I've heard in a long time. Actually, that's the best news I've heard since I stood in a valley with a giant. It just doesn't get any better than that. Irony just doesn't get any better than that. It's almost too much. It's amazing. What it is it's God screaming, "I'm in control." You see, the circumstance can't appear any It can't appear much worse for David. And yet God twists things in just such a way where we get this delicious, ironic detail that reminds us that God is working all of this out. Chapter 29, verse 1. "Now the Philistines had gathered all their forces at Aphek." All there is a decisive word. This is to be a decisive confrontation, not just a couple of units, but all of the forces of the Philistine. This is to be a decisive battle. and the Israelites were encamped by the spring that is in Jezreel. They are at a strategic location here. The battle is about to commence at this point. It seems like the situation for David is fraught with potential disaster and difficulty and even death. He doesn't need to go into battle. It doesn't need to appear that David is involved in killing Saul, even if he refuses to do it and have anything to do with it. It doesn't need to appear that David is involved in the death of Saul. That is political, a nightmare for David to have to deal with. That doesn't need to happen at all. And yet things are unfolding. Certainly David is willing to go into battle and help the Israelites from the standpoint of where it stands, but he doesn't seem like this is a good thing. But the irony cannot be missed. God, in the way he's unfolding this and in the way he unfolds even the dialogue that is said, is reminding everyone, I'm in control. And the irony continues as the soldiers of the Philistines, they remember the head. Look with me in chapter 29, verses 2 through 8. Look with me beginning in verse 2. As the lords, or that is the rulers, of the Philistines were passing on by hundreds and by thousands, that's simply language for the units of the military troops, and David and his men were passing on in the rear with Achish, that is Achish the king of Gath. David was a personal bodyguard, the keeper of the head of Achish. There he is traveling with him in the rear. Verse 3, the commanders of the Philistines said, what are these Hebrews doing here? And Achish said to the commanders of the Philistines, is this not David, the servant of Saul, king of Israel, who has been with me now for days and years? And since he deserted to me, I have found no fault in him to this day. Can you imagine? You're about to go into battle with Israel, and there you are, the commanders of the Philistine army, and there you see a band of Hebrews heading in the troop. What in the world are we doing? Why would they be with us? That is the enemy. Achish, king of Gath, says, what do you mean? This is David. He used to be with Saul, but he defected to me. He's been loyal to me. He's been with me over a year. I trust him. And notice the language that he uses. I have found no fault with him to this day. And by the way, he pronounces David guiltless three times. Verse 3, verse 6, verse 9. I find no fault in this man. It's a familiar sort of language for those of us who are familiar with the New Testament. But he keeps saying it. Verses 4 and 5. But the commanders of the Philistines were angry, or the word is furious, with him. And the commanders of the Philistines said to him, send the man back, that he may return to the place which you have assigned him. He shall not go down with us to battle, lest in the battle he become an adversary to us. The word adversary, the word Satan, he become a Satan to us, an adversary to us, an enemy to us. And by the way, they've got every reason to believe that. You remember what happened in 1 Samuel 14, 20 and 21? They had Hebrews with them. It says, then Saul and all the people who were with him rallied and went into battle, and behold, every Philistine's sword was against his fellow, and there was very great confusion. Now the Hebrews, who had been with the Philistines before that time and who had gone up with them into the camp, they also turned to be with the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. They said, listen, we've seen this before. We know this trick. We know these Hebrews who camp with us, who act like we're with us. We get into battle with the Israelites. They turn on us. We know what's going on here. We've seen this all before. But even more than that, even more than the fact that we've seen this all before, we know who that one is. You see, David has a reputation. Notice what they say. For how could this fellow reconcile himself to his Lord or his ruler? Would it not be with the heads of the men here? Oh, yeah, we know about that guy. You know how he got his wife? He got his wife by chopping off the head of a Gathite and by chopping off some other stuff among our people. He got his wife by wielding a sword against us. Yeah, he's in the outs with Saul right now. How in the world could he get right with Saul? What if he walked in just like he did with Goliath, with the heads of us? It wouldn't be that hard. We've seen this before. We know how he works. We remember the head. We know this is a man that cuts off heads. Their fear was absolutely appropriate, by the way. The men were right. David's allegiance had been proven again and again. He was with the Lord, and he was with the Lord's anointed. He would not have fought against Israel, which makes all of this dialogue all the more ironic. These men intuitively understand that this man is a man who crushes the head of the enemies of God and God's people. They understand that. We know who this guy is. We know that he's liable to march around with our heads in his hand. And after all, they say, we not only remember the head, not only is there a visual, theological illustration that bounces in our minds, there's also a theological song that we remember. Verse 5, is not this David of whom they sing to one another in dances? Saul struck down his thousands and David his 10,000s. There's even a musical lesson that goes along with it. Do you see? Achish, have you lost your mind? You don't have just some stray Israelite. There are little children marching around with stumps in their hands pretending like they are David. There are little girls running around holding hands singing the David song. Saul has killed his thousands, David his tens of thousands. This is who we're dealing with. If it were today, there would be David action figures. This is not just anybody. What in the world are you doing? And they're right. Verse 6. Then Achish called David and said to him, "As the Lord lives, you have been honest, and to me it seems right that you should march out and in with me in the campaign, for I have found nothing wrong in you from the day of your coming to me to this day." The second pronouncement of guiltlessness. "Nevertheless, the lords or the rulers do not approve of you. So go back now and go peaceably, that you may not displease the lords of the Philistines." And David said to Achish, "But what have I done? What have you found in your servant from the day I entered your service until now, that I may not go and fight against the enemies of my Lord the King?" And by the way, that's consistently the exact language and title that he uses for Saul. 24, 8, 10, 26, 17, and 18. That's the exact language he uses for Saul. "That I may not go and fight against the enemies of my Lord the King." Understand this, when David recognizes the King, he recognizes Saul as the Lord's anointed. So much so that though Saul did everything he could to take his life, when he had the opportunity to take Saul's life, he absolutely steadfastly refused. The pagans are struck with a sense of fear because of a mighty act of God. They remember the head. But notice what they're sending him away does. It's fascinating. By the way, they seemed to be more attuned to the right sense of awe about what God had done in this man than the Israelites. But notice what their fear does. Their fear says, get him away from us. So get him away from us to thwart anything that might happen through him to us, right? If we get him away from us, he will not harm us. But what happens when they get their wish? What happens? Well, when they send him away, we see in verses 9 through 11 and what follows, the crusher of the head. Look with me at verses 9 through 11. And Achish answered David and said, I know that you are as blameless in my sight as an angel of God. By the way, the commanders feared David as a Satan, as an adversary. Achish says, you're as blameless in my sight as a messenger of God. Nevertheless, the commanders of the Philistines have said, he shall not go up with us in battle. By the way, it's chock full of irony. Achish defended David's loyalty when David was deceiving him. Saul believed David was an enemy, even though David did him no harm and defended his life. Achish made him the keeper of his head, and Saul tried to kill him. Achish proclaimed his innocence, and Saul sought his life. Everything's the opposite of what you would expect. And note this. The commanders demand that he not go into battle, prevents David from even being accused of having any hand in the death of Saul, which is soon coming. And then note the phrase that appears three times in a row in verses 10 and 11. Now then rise early in the morning with the servants of your Lord who came with you and start early in the morning and depart as soon as you have light. So David set out with his men early in the morning to return to the land of the Philistines. But the Philistines went up to Jezreel. Now understand this, as we have these recurring phrases, what's going on here is not just a time marker. It's not just laboring to tell us what time of day it happened to be. When you have phraseology repeated like this, there's more going on to that. It's telling us that what's going on in the actions of these rulers coming to pass, there is the dawning of a new day. There is a new morning happening. There is something going on with David leaving that camp that is the dawning of a new day. And it's coming to pass according to the command of these wicked pagan rulers. They are getting what they want, and it is accomplishing the dawning of a new day. They delivered David from that camp. They delivered him from being accused of the death of Saul. They delivered David, as we go on, we're going to find out, to find a camp that had been raided by the Amalekites. We find David rising up once again, acting as king to go defeat the enemies of God. He goes and tracks down the Amalekites. He strikes them down. And parallel with that, with David again acting as king, defeating the enemies of God, the Philistines are killing Saul, and Saul is dead. So the Philistines drive David out, getting what they want. He finds the Amalekites have raided the camp. He chases them down. He destroys them, which is what Saul never did, though he was commanded by the Lord to do it. The Philistines do away with Saul, which puts everything in place for David to be recognized among the people as king. So David is recognized among the people as king. And what's one of the first things he does? he destroys the Philistines. That's the way God works. That is the irony of God unfolding the amazing story of His sovereign purposes. They thought they were getting rid of Him. Get Him out of here. We will protect ourselves if we get Him out of here. We will save our heads. They're very evil action assured the crushing of their heads. Peter preaching. Acts 2:23. This Jesus, delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men. What? What is it? Is it the unfolding of the purposes of God? Or is it the actions of wicked and lawless men who are guilty? Yeah. And the story keeps hitting us off guard. When the final head crusher comes, he dies. When the final head crusher comes, he's crucified at the hands of wicked men. The irony unfolds and unfolds and unfolds. This Jesus, delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God. Jesus, the unfolding of the purposes of God. All of this has been working to this moment in time according to the sovereign purposes of God. You crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men. You said, let's stop this. Let's kill him. Let's do away with this. Let's stop him before he crushes our head. Let's kill him. Let's stop it. And in the very act of the crucifixion of Christ, there is the sealing of the fate of the salvation of all who would believe, and the crushing of the head of the serpent and all who are opposed to the purposes of God. If you miss the irony, you miss the story. So, when you are experiencing a genuine lack of control over some circumstance in your life, should you assume it's the problem, or should you assume it's the point? Now, note the word genuine. I don't mean some lack of control because you're lazy. That's a spiritual problem that needs to be repented of. I don't mean some lack of control because of some lack of discipline. I don't mean some lack of control because of some sin run amok. I mean some genuine lack of control. Happens all the time. The disease is real. Happens all the time. Somebody really turns their back on you. It happens all the time. Somebody really is dying that you love and care about. Genuine lack of control over circumstance. Maybe you should assume that God has a point in it, and not just simply that your lack of control over the circumstance is the problem. Because understand this, there is no circumstance that he doesn't have control over. And he could change it. But he hasn't. And he's taught you that you don't even know, and I don't even know, how to line things up and say, I know exactly how it's going to come out. So what he's taught you is to trust him and expect to see the unfolding irony of the gospel again and again and again. Because what he does is better than the way we would have done it in the end. Let's pray.